DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
Following a week of terror attacks in Nigeria, we ask how people there are reacting to the threat from Islamist group Boko Haram.
We meet survivors of the Boston Marathon blast 1 year on.
As it's going up, you realize, you know, this is distracting for the first 5 seconds. Then you see it's all coming at you like a big wave of water and it's washing over your head. And you hear everybody screaming, but you can no longer see anybody. And I looked at my partner and I was like, what do we do?
And we meet a sister struggling with grief decades after her brother was shot on Bloody Sunday.
All these stories and more coming up on Worldlink.
You're listening to DW's Worldlink. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
There are two words which for the past 5 years have become synonymous with fear for millions of Nigerians. Boko Haram. The extreme Islamist group has killed thousands in its quest to turn Nigeria into an Islamic state. Africa's most populous nation is currently made up of mainly Muslims in its north and Christians in its south.
Boko Haram has been accused this week of kidnapping more than 100 girls aged between 15 and 18 who were studying for exams at a northeastern high school. The group's also been blamed for setting off a bomb blast at a bus station on the outskirts of the capital, Abuja, in the centre of the country, which killed at least 75 people.
Earlier, we spoke with Nigerian journalist Sam Olukoya, who is based in the city of Lagos. We began by asking him whether this is the beginning of a new broad-scale terror campaign by Boko Haram.
Yes, that's what most people believe, that we have to look at it even beyond this week and go as far back as January. We've seen a very sustained attack since January of this year, and Amnesty International says as at the end of March, that's within 3 months, at least 1,500 people have been killed. I mean, we've seen so many killings that have taken place so far in this month.
Sam, how are the authorities in Nigeria responding to these attacks?
You can see they are responding at two levels, what they say and then what actually we found on the ground. All the while they've been saying they are putting in everything to arrest those who are responsible for the acts, but on the ground we don't see much evidence of this. Rather, we see an escalation of the violence. I'll give an example. Following the abduction of these schoolgirls, the military said they've rescued many of them, at least as of Thursday, but reports coming from the school where these girls were abducted said virtually more than 100 girls are still missing, whereas the military said their effort has led to the recovery of more than 100 girls, as just 8 of the girls are still missing. So what the military is saying is quite different from what is happening on the ground.
Have you heard then from any families who can confirm that they've received their children back?
Well, some families actually said they received their children back, but I mean, these were not the result of the military action. They were just the result of the girls escaping. The vehicles with which the Boko Haram militants were conveying the girls, many of these vehicles broke down and the girls were able to escape.
And do you know, well, what sort of accounts these girls have given? What happened during their abduction?
First, the girls are highly traumatized with the kind of experience they went through. And one significant thing is that the Boko Haram told them that they have been warned not to go to school. The Boko Haram members are saying because they disobeyed this order, that's why they have been abducted.
Sam, given that Boko Haram translates as Western education is forbidden, there is a certain degree of perverse logic in targeting a school. But why blow up a bus stop?
Well, that's what everybody is asking. I will say that blowing up a bus stop, a number of buses, abducting schoolgirls, it doesn't give them any military advantage. Somebody was analyzing it that, look, you are dealing with people who are on drugs. I mean, based on what the military have told us in the past that after the arrest from some of these camps, quite a large quantity of drugs were found with them. That, on one hand, might explain this. The other might be the need to make a name around the world, and which I think they've been able to make within a very short time. I think Boko Haram has succeeded in making a name, and I mean, you will agree with me, that had been at very, very great cost, at human cost to human life. What I think they've done is that you have a group that had looked around and studied other groups around the world and adopted some of their worst techniques. Clearly, abduction of schoolgirls is what we saw in Uganda by the rebels there. The use of bombs, we've seen that in Afghanistan, Iraq. And so some of the very worst techniques, the beheading of people from Iraq. So they've sort of brought in all these things together and are now using them very, very effectively in getting the kind of publicity they want to get.
Aside from the lacking structures, what needs to be done to resolve this conflict with Boko Haram, which has claimed the lives of thousands since 2009? Do you think that negotiations towards a peaceful solution is possible with such a group?
Well, many people in Nigeria are now saying that we've lost that time. Boko Haram has grown into a monster, and what you can just do now is to crush it. That time for negotiation has passed, and I think that the government actually carries quite a lot of blame. Politicians, let me put it that way, they are more interested in the elections coming up next year, not on the security situation that is affecting the country. So unless they forget their ambition and go back to the drawing board and say, what can we honestly do to arrest this situation? Until that time, the problem will continue. And the fact that most of the victims of this crime are the very, very poor people. The rich have not been threatened. So as far as some of them are concerned, it's not my headache. So long as it doesn't affect them, the zeal to try to arrest the situation is not there. But until they see Nigeria as one constituency where the problem of somebody affects everybody, I'm afraid the situation is not likely to change.
That was journalist Sam Olukoya talking to us from Lagos, Nigeria.
For more information, go to our webpage, dw.de.
On Monday, the annual Boston Marathon is being held under highly tightened security. It's been a year since the race was targeted in twin bomb attacks, which left 3 people dead and hundreds of others injured. You'll remember the blasts were timed 12 seconds apart and exploded as the biggest wave of runners reached the finishing line.
While the case of bombing suspect Chuka Tsarnaev, who was 19 years old at the time, goes through the court process, the people of Boston, who suffered the events of that day, bear the scars of tragedy both physically and mentally. For DW, Lindsay Melling has been finding out how 2 women, both survivors of the bombings, are moving on with their lives.
Cheers.
Celebrations just a few days ago as Rebecca Gregory and Peter DeMartino tied the knot at a dream wedding ceremony. Rebecca and Peter took their vows in front of 150 family and friends. But the joy of the occasion masks a serious story. This couple have come a remarkably long way in 12 months.
Beautiful cake behind us, here made by Cake Alchemy.
Less than a year ago, they were recovering in hospital, having both been devastatingly injured in the Boston bombing. They'd been waiting for DeMartino's mother to pass the finishing line when the first bomb went off. Rebecca, who instinctively shielded her son, broke almost every bone in her foot, leg and ankle and is currently waiting to have her left leg amputated. DeMartino lost 90% of his right Achilles tendon and broke multiple bones in his ankle. Speaking to guests at their wedding, staged in a romantic rural setting in Asheville, North Carolina, Rebecca found it hard to contain her feelings about the past 12 months.
To be able to share our wedding and our relationship and our struggles with so many people. And I can't tell you what the last year of having everyone with us has meant, because we truly could not have gotten through it without you guys. And for the first time today, I was able to walk down the aisle, and that's something that I haven't done in a year now. We have a long recovery to go, but with the people that are here in this room, we can do it. And I'm just so excited to celebrate, and I love this man so much.
Rebecca is just one of the victims of the Boston bombing who is attempting to rebuild her life in the face of adversity. Another is 37-year-old Lynn Kriske, who lives close to the marathon course.
Well, they tell you on long runs you're forbidden any kind of fiber. So you're supposed to have only creamy peanut butter. I'm not supposed to have wheat bread. I'm supposed to have only white bread.
Lynn is busy preparing to walk the distance, despite sustaining crippling injuries last year.
I know I can do it physically, which is way more than I could have said a month ago. I've overcome a lot of mistakes. Two Saturdays ago, I did 20 miles. So that's practically a marathon.
But Lynn's battle back from the impact of the bombing is even more remarkable because she was already a chronic pain sufferer. Just 7 years earlier, Lynn, who used to be a singer, tripped on a cable while on stage and nearly died. She was left wheelchair-bound and sustained brainstem injuries.
So I had to relearn to walk again over 6 years, and I had blew a hole in my deep in my ear canal, which had to be surgically repaired, which left me with vertigo for many years. I had to retrain physical therapy for my eyes because they didn't work as a pair anymore, and constant migraines. There was just so many little things. I was bedbound for years and had to work my way very slowly by, you know, maybe standing in front of the wheelchair for 5 minutes. That was the exercise several times a day. And then working your way up further from that, walking from one end of the room to the other while crawling along the wall. That was an exercise that went on for months.
And then came Boston. Lynn and her partner Doug have found a place to watch the marathon near the finish line.
We were sitting on, you know, the corner table so that I could watch the Jumbotron and see the runners coming up on the left. And it was two storefronts down from Marathon Sports where the explosion was, so it's about 40 feet. When we heard the first explosion, I wasn't sure what to do. I think people go into fight or flight or freeze, and everybody in my area froze. I watched for 5 or 6 seconds. You saw red and then orange in the first second and then black smoke, and then it went from dark gray to light and up over 5 stories high over the buildings within like 5 seconds. I'd never seen anything grow so fast. And then as it's going up, you realize, you know, this is distracting for the first 5 seconds. Then you see it's all coming at you like a big wave of water, and it's washing over your head. And you hear everybody screaming, but you can no longer see anybody. And I looked at my partner, and I was like, what do we do? And he said, it's just a transformer. Don't, you know, because he's used to me panicking. And then my dog went nuts. And so I looked at Doug at like second 9, second 10, and I'm like, I got to go. And then second explosion.
The explosions and the scrum to escape badly aggravated Lynn's historic injuries, but they brought even more trauma. She suffered hearing and brain damage, making life since the attack even more of a daily struggle.
I noticed when I sat down finally, hours later, when I stopped pacing and shaking and all that, when I sat down, it hurt. I went to the ER the next day. I went to MGH. They were having the worst work day of their life. They just didn't have the means to service people who did not have life-threatening injuries. So all it says on my ER report is anxiety. The doctor that I went to, Dr. Shamali, about the tinnitus, had one conversation with me and said, you have a brain injury, you know that, right? And I said, no, no one told me I had a brain injury.
Added to all this, Lynn suffers from debilitating post-traumatic stress disorder, which makes dealing with crowds of people and stressful situations very difficult. But as her injuries are not physically obvious, she has struggled to gain recognition and help as a survivor.
I don't have anything that you can photograph that's going to sell magazines or TV ads for a big CNN interview with anyone important. But the invisible injuries that I live with and the invisible pain that I live with hurt just as much, if not more, as the sensational injuries and what I've gotten since the marathon countless times by very well-meaning people is, well, you don't look injured, and then they smile and pat you on the back and it sends shooting pains down your back. I mean, I laugh because I'm sort of, on a good day, I laugh. On a bad day, I cry. It depends on how you catch me.
Despite all this, she is planning to take part in this year's Boston Marathon as part of a team of bombing survivors.
I've never run in my life, and I am training for the marathon. I've never jogged. I'd never been on a treadmill. I call myself the turtle of the team. We have a team of runners that are all marathon survivors. The method that I have to use to get through this is to have dozens, 26 for 26 miles, if you will, different walks and different slow jogs.
Lynn is running or walking to raise money and awareness for the US Pain Foundation.
I am the turtle. I am the tortoise.
After all the hard work through her continuing recovery, she is looking forward to taking part in this, her first marathon.
I'm there. I'm psyched. I can't wait to feel the energy of the excitement of all these people. They're so happy to be there, and they traveled so far, and they trained for so long, and they're just like spewing all this energy about how excited they are this day is finally here. It's Marathon Monday.
Boston bombing survivor and first-time marathon runner Lynn Criskey, ending that report from Lindsay Melling.
And as well as Marathon Monday, many parts of the world are celebrating Easter weekend. That weekend has a particular significance in Northern Ireland, where at Easter 1998, the so-called Good Friday Agreement was signed. This accord between the British and the Irish governments eventually led to the end of years of violence between those, mainly Catholics, who wanted Ireland to be united, and those, mainly Protestants, who wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom.
16 years on, there have been calls for an amnesty to be offered to all those involved in the decades of bloodshed, which became known as the Troubles and claimed the lives of thousands on both sides. Despite the relative peace enjoyed now, with a highly symbolic visit by the Irish president to Britain earlier this month, the memories of the past remain raw, especially for the relatives of those who died on Bloody Sunday in 1972. Ashley Byrne has been speaking to Kay Duddy, who lost her brother in the massacre.
17-year-old Jackie was one of some 3,600 people who were killed in the so-called Troubles, which lasted for nearly three decades from the 1960s in Northern Ireland. They say time heals, but the memories of the past still loom large, and Kay Duddy remains angry at a life cut short so young.
Jackie was one of my younger brothers, and he had a great love of music. He had a few girlfriends, he went to the boxing club, and he was a great amateur boxer.
Bloody Sunday had started with a civil rights parade through the streets of Derry.
There was men, women, children, a few people with prams, and that's the way they left that afternoon. And as the march progressed over the street a bit, you could hear them starting to sing.
Jackie was one of those who joined the march that day.
He had his jeans and he had like a red wool type polo shirt and a jacket. That's what he wanted to know, did he look okay? You know, so, I mean, that's the kind of frame of mind that he went out.
That was the last time Kay would see her brother alive. Just a few hours later, he would become the first of 14 men and boys to be gunned down when British troops opened fire on protesters. One of those who would run to Jackie's rescue was Bishop Daly, then Father Daly, a young curate working in the Bogside, a Catholic region of Derry.
They were running in the same direction, and he ran past Jackie, and the next thing he heard was the shot and like a gasp. And when he looked, Jackie was on the ground. We thought he was actually shot in the back. It was through the shoulder and it came out his chest. The shooting was so intense that Father Daly and all the other people around dived for cover. And when the shooting subsided slightly, he crawled out, him and some other men crawled out to Jackie.
Daly used a handkerchief to cover Jackie's gunshot wound before reading him the last rites. That bloodstained handkerchief would soon become famous.
He waved the white hanky when they were carrying Jackie away to try and get him to safety. Because at that stage they thought he was still alive. And he had put the hanky first to try and stem the flow of blood. But then he took the hanky out and waved it like a flag in front of them so as they wouldn't get stopped.
Film footage of Father Daly waving the handkerchief through the streets in his bid to get Jackie to hospital was beamed around the world. But back home, the Duddy family were oblivious to what was happening just a short distance away.
An aunt of mine came to the door and said that she had heard that Jackie was hurt downtown. We didn't have a phone at home, so we went to the local community centre and I phoned the hospital to find out if Jackie Duddy had been admitted that afternoon. A few minutes elapsed and they came back and reaffirmed who was making the inquiry. And I was informed on the phone that Jackie Duddy was dead on admission to hospital. So it's still a blur. It's still... vaguely remember screaming and throwing the phone in the air. You know, as I say then, the kind of the trauma must have set in once I got home. It's kind of nearly a blank for 3 days.
What actually happened on January the 30th, 1972, was disputed for years until an inquiry led by Lord Justice Savile and set up by the UK government was heavily critical of the British Army. Just a few weeks ago, former UK Northern Ireland Minister Peter Hain called for an amnesty to be offered to those responsible for killing, bombing and maiming during the 30 years of the conflict. But the British Prime Minister David Cameron has argued that there isn't much chance of forgiving, saying the Prime Minister does not support the idea of amnesties. The Police Service of Northern Ireland, meanwhile, has also said it's actively considering bringing murder prosecutions against retired soldiers involved in Bloody Sunday. Kay Duddy believes someone must answer for the deaths.
It's very, very hard even now. It's still, I always said, Jackie has been buried in the cemetery. But I need a chance to lay Jackie to rest because of this forthcoming murder inquiry. After all these years, we still can't lay them to rest. We can't leave our loved ones to rest. And that, for me, still hurts a terrible, terrible lot. We never wanted vengeance, but all we wanted was truth and justice for the loss of our loved ones. And I don't really feel that that's too big a thing to ask, considering what happened that day.
Of course, whether prosecutions are brought or not, there are some questions Kay and her family will never be able to answer.
I lost a brother. We lost a whole generation because when the rest of the family got married and had a family and had a life, it always left you wondering, would he have turned a professional boxer? Would he have made that his career? Would he have married? Would he have had a wife? Would he have had children? But I've had more nieces and nephews. And the sad fact is there's so many questions left unanswered. And he was just a happy-go-lucky 17-year-old that went out that day with no malice or intent in his mind or his heart because he hadn't a malice intent in his body. And I just feel that the truth and the justice for Jackie and the rest of the deceased and the wounded is very, very important.
Out of all the trauma and heartache, though, has come a lasting friendship. Kay Duddy and Father Daly, now Bishop Daly, didn't know each other before Bloody Sunday, but they've made up for it since.
He's like a saint to us, you know, he's so very, very special in our hearts because he was there with Jackie in his dying moments, and that means so, so much to us, you know. It was a great source of comfort. He was a great priest, he was a fabulous bishop, and a wonderful, wonderful person. And he always said, until he would draw his dying breath, he would tell the story time and again and time and again, that Jackie was innocent.
Kay Duddy, sister of Bloody Sunday victim Jackie Duddy, ending that report by Ashley Byrne.
You're listening to DW's World Link. I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
This is DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
In the second half of the show, we'll be hearing from the prize-winning Bangladeshi blogger who was almost killed by Islamists, gagged and hounded by the authorities, and has for the time being found safety in Germany.
Plus, we talk to the European filmmaker couple who have made it their mission to spread the message of a unique utopian village in Ethiopia.
Every Tuesday, Neil, everyone in Avramba, whatever work they do that day, it contributes to a pot that goes towards helping people that are less fortunate than them. And we've seen the results of this, and it's amazing. So one day a week, every single week, since the beginning, we believe, they work towards charity.
These stories and more coming up in the next half hour here on Worldlink.
Now, our regular Worldlink listeners will remember Asif Muhyiddin. He's the prize-winning atheist Bangladeshi blogger who was almost killed by suspected Islamists in Dhaka in 2013. He's also one of the founders of the Shabak movement, which took to the streets of the capital that same year to demand the death penalty for Islamist war criminals. Back then, I spoke to Asif twice over Skype, once while he was recovering from the severe injuries he suffered in the assassination attempt, and once after his blog, which was the most popular in the country, was banned by the authorities for being anti-government and anti-religious. Both times, Asif was speaking to me while in hiding, and I can say now that all of us here were rather concerned about his safety back then, which is why I'm all the more happy to say that today we're finally meeting him in the flesh, because he's right here in the studio with us now. Asif, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Asif, as I just explained, last time we spoke was under very different circumstances. You're in Germany now, after hiding from both your own government and Islamists for months. How did you manage to leave the country and get to Germany?
That was not very easy. When I was in the airport, the police, the immigration department asked me many questions, and I had to stay there for 1.5 hours. But that was really difficult, and they asked me for the papers from the court that I can leave the country. Then I asked them that if I have any restriction to leave the country from the court, do you have any papers that I have some restriction? Then they told me no.
You were able to leave then?
Yeah.
Okay. But last time we spoke, as I understood it, the government was actively looking for you.
Yeah.
And that they weren't looking for you anymore when you tried to leave at the airport.
They called few detective branches, and now there is four detective branches in Bangladesh, and they called all of them, and they said it's okay, he can leave. I don't know why. Maybe they were thinking that it is safe for them if I leave the country.
That it was better to get rid of
you. Yeah.
Okay. And now you were invited by Amnesty International, if I understood correctly?
Yeah, first I was invited by the Amnesty International to join some seminars about human rights and rights of women, rights of gay, lesbian, rights of religious minorities. And now I got the scholarship from Hamburg Foundation, and I will stay here for another 1 year.
Wow. So, Asif, how has your life changed then since you left Bangladesh?
Now I'm feeling safe and secured. When I was in Bangladesh, most of the time I was in prison. After I got released from the prison, I was not feeling safe because all the time I had to wear a mask because they posted my picture all over the city and in Chittagong, in Sylhet and in Dhaka. And most of the people know me. My picture was all over the newspaper and TV. And most of the time I had to stay at home for the security reason. And now I'm like a free bird. And I can walk to the streets without any fear. So it's very comfortable and very. I feel very safe here.
What was so controversial or so blasphemous in the statements that you made? Can you perhaps give us some examples of statements that Islamists consider particularly offensive?
Yeah, of course. I wrote a blog about women rights. If you read the Quran, then you can find in Surah Nisa ayat 34 that says that a man can beat his wife if the wife does not obey her husband, and I criticize that. And modern civilization, there is no place for hitting anybody. There are other many verses that says that a Muslim should kill the Jews and. Yes, something like that, and the non-believers, that should not be practiced in modern society. Also, according to Sharia law, if someone leaves Islam, then they had to kill that person. So I don't think that is a very good thing to practice. So I criticize that. And that's why they were very angry, and I also criticized the leader of Islamic political parties, the most powerful Islamic political leader right now. His name is Allama Shafi, and he said that women should not study after class 4. Women should always stay at home, take care of her children and her husband. This is the only one duty for women, and I don't think that is a very good practice for modern civilization, modern society, and I criticize that. That's why the Islamic leader, Allama Shafi, was very angry with me, and he put my name on the list, and he mentioned my name a few times that I should be killed because I criticize his ideology and also the Quran and the Hadith also. And also I also criticize Bible and the Hindu religious books. Mm-hmm. Which parts are not compatible with modern society.
So, Asif, it seems that you have in no way stopped saying the things that you were saying on your blog that got you into trouble with the Islamists and extremists, and you almost paid for that with your life last year.
Yeah.
Almost. Has anything come of the investigation into that? Has anybody been held to account for that?
There is a fundamentalist group in Bangladesh. The name is Ansarullah Bangla Team. They said that they did it. So I know who attacked me, the Ansarullah Bangla Team and the Hefazat Islam and Jamaat Islam, these political parties. And I also met my attackers when I was in prison. My attackers were in the same cell where I was. They put me in that cell where the attackers and the Islamists were together, and we had a nice discussion. Yeah,
you had a nice discussion.
Yeah. I asked them that why did you? They recognized me, and I was a little bit famous in when I was in prison. Everybody knows that atheist blogger is here, living here. So many people came to visit me in the prison, and they also came to visit me. Then I asked them that, why did you attack me? They told me that you left Islam and you are no longer a Muslim and you criticize the Quran. So we had to do that. Then I asked him that if you got released from the prison, what you will do? Then they told me that they will try it again. So, yes, that was okay. It is their ideology. But I told them that I will write against you, but I will never attack you or do anything that is violent. I will not do that. But I will write against your ideology.
So are you still worried then about the prospect of being attacked again?
Yes. A few days ago, just 15 days ago, they posted a Facebook note that Asif Muhyiddin should be killed and someone should go to Germany and kill him. They also posted it in Facebook and they got maybe 1,200 likes, and many of them shared that post. Yes, they're still looking for me, and I'm still the number one enemy of Islam, I think, in Bangladesh.
So even though you have met these people and spoken to them face to face and said that you do not pose a physical threat to them, you're still a target. That hasn't changed. Meeting you face to face hasn't changed anything in terms of their opinion of you.
No, they will never change. Because of their education system, they will become a fundamentalist. If you want to change their opinion, then you have to start from the beginning, from their school.
How well do you know the Quran? I mean, you're an atheist now, but did you grow up reading the Quran?
Or? Yeah, of course. I was a believer of Islam when I was 13 or 14. Then I understood that everything written in the religious books are fake, lies. I don't believe there is a person living in the sky, watching all over the world. I don't believe that. And yes, I read Quran and Hadith many times, and I criticize many of the Hadiths that is not compatible with modern society.
But is it a case then of live and let live? I mean, will you respect people who want to pursue a religious life and live according to the Quran, or is it something you want to change actively and convert them to become atheists?
No, no, no. I never tried to convert anyone to be an atheist. Yes, it is okay if someone personally believe in God or believe in Quran or Hadith, it is okay. I don't have any problem with that. But if someone want to impose Sharia law in our society, in our culture, in our laws, then I have problems because they should not decide that women should not go out, women should not study. They should not decide that. This is modern society, and we are living here. We should not practice the laws which are 1,400 years ago, and we should not cut the hands of the thieves. We should not throw stones to a woman who have some relationship with another person. We should not practice these things. But it is in our village, in the many villages of Bangladesh, they practice this kind of laws, especially Sharia laws, and I should criticize that.
Perhaps if we talk a bit about domestic politics, the domestic issues in Bangladesh. You were one of the coordinators of the 2013 protests of the Shabak movement, who were calling for the banning of Islamist parties and also calling for the death penalty of Islamists guilty of war crimes in the 1971 War of Independence from Pakistan. And in December, the Islamist opposition leader Abdul Qadar Mollah was executed following major demonstrations and counter demonstrations. How did you personally feel about his execution and also about the deaths that occurred as a result of the protests?
Actually, I'm not in the favor of death penalty. I never supported death penalty. But we started a movement against the war criminals, and my ideology was to ban Islamic political parties. And I told them when we had that movement, I told them many times that our number one agenda should be separation of religion and politics, not the death penalty of Qadar Mullah. But we had a huge debate, and most of the people wanted the death penalty of Qadar Mullah. And yes, it is democracy, and I had to follow them. But personally, I don't support death penalty, and I was silent at that time.
I remember last time we spoke, it sounded more like you were advocating death penalty for convicted war criminals because they deserved it. Have your emotions or your views changed since then?
No. 4 years ago, I wrote a blog against death penalty. But if the government of Bangladesh is practicing death penalties, and so why not the war criminals? Mm-hmm. I think like that. The poor people of Bangladesh, many of them, they don't have money for a lawyer. They are getting death penalties. So why not them? I think like that.
What are you planning to do now? You're in Germany for a year on a scholarship. What are you going to do when that ends next April? Will you go back to Bangladesh?
After 1 year, I will go back to Bangladesh. We started many things and I have to go back there and start my movement again. I am also coordinator of one blogger organization in Bangladesh, and 2 days ago we also had a protest against the government. I should tell you one thing, that two of our blogger, they are only 17 years old. Now they are in prison for blasphemous blog post. Actually, they wrote something about evolution theory in their Facebook, and contradiction between Quran and evolution theory. And 2 days ago, our organization had a protest against it, and I also wrote for their release. And there is a new law called ICT Act. And that says that if someone wrote something in the blog or Facebook that hurt the religious feelings of other people, then they will be sentenced 7 years to 14 years in prison. For me, it is absolutely nonsense and absolutely stupid law, and I'm protesting against that law. And I will go back to Bangladesh and will still continue my things.
Why go back to a country where you've been locked up, you've almost been murdered, and it's likely that both could happen again if you return?
Because I have to go to Bangladesh because they are my people. I cannot just run away from the situation. I have to fight back, and yes, they can kill me, but there will be a lot of other people, they will fight back after my death, I think. One of our famous writer, Humayun Azad, he was also attacked. And many of our famous intellectual, they fought with them, the fundamentalist. And I think that I'm also a soldier of that war. Not physical war, it is ideological war, ideological fight. And yes, I have to do that for the people of Bangladesh. And most of the people of Bangladesh, they are very poor and they don't have any education. And so the religious leaders can influence them. So I have to do something for them. I'm not a very patriot person. I don't believe in nationalism. I don't think that Bangladesh is my country. All the world is my country. But the people, I have to do something for the people of Bangladesh.
Asif Mohyuddin, prize-winning atheist Bangladeshi blogger, here with us in the studio today. Thank you very much for joining us on Worldling.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Our next story takes us to Ethiopia. 40 years ago, in the rural region of Amhara, there was a young farmer who decided the patriarchal society in which he lived needed to change. Zumra Nuru wanted to create a place where men and women would make decisions together, both at home and in society. So he decided to found his own village, Arumba.
Ever since I was a 4-year-old boy living with my parents, I was observing what was going on in our society. Women were treated like house slaves. Some men would beat and insult their wives and even throw them out of the house. I wanted to put these things right.
That's village founder Zumra Nuru speaking in a documentary directed by the European filmmaker couple Paulina Tervo and Sada Ferit. After shooting their first documentary on the village in 2008, Paulina and Serda embarked on a more ambitious project to spread the message of Arumba around the globe, the so-called Arumba Experience. This is a collaborative, interactive web documentary designed for tablets and computers that allows you to click your way through the village and exchange knowledge with other viewers and the community. Earlier, Paulina and Serda joined me on the line from Helsinki, Finland, to tell me more about the project and the village. I started by asking them what struck them the most on entering Arumba for the first time.
For me, it was the serenity. It's a quiet place, but not in a stiff kind of European way that you might find in Northern Europe. Birds are chirping, people are happily getting on with their lives without any unnecessary drama. I guess you could describe it as harmonious in a way. Certainly different. It's a different feeling to other places we've both been to or lived in.
And I think what fascinated me as well is that what they've done is virtually impossible in the surroundings that they're in. The context being it's a very rural part of Ethiopia that has very conservative values and old traditions that people live by. And the fact that they've kind of gone against those traditions in a way that they've decided to discuss what's wrong with society and change the things that they believe are harmful. That is so incredibly astounding for
me. It's rare, not just in their own context, but anywhere. You try and change strong traditions anywhere you go in the world. It's not very easy. And I think let's take the context thing out of that. Whatever context you're in, I think that's impressive.
Yeah, and I think we were also curious about how it really works and what does it take to set something like this up? So we've really been focusing on these issues as well in our film.
And what would you say are the main issues in Arumba?
When we started the project, we actually sat down with the community and we discussed what are the issues that are most important to their way of life and the things that they've changed. And collaboratively, we came up with 10 themes and we focused on these 10 themes as part of our documentary. The 10 themes are gender equality,
faith and peace,
education,
independence from aid, sustainable growth, healthcare, elderly care,
family planning,
democracy,
yes, and charity. Because
and charity, yeah.
Actually, one of the most incredible things about Arumba is that they help people who are in a worse position themselves. So
every Tuesday, Neil, everyone in Arumba, bar none, whatever work they do that day, it contributes to a pot that goes towards helping people that are less fortunate than them. And we've seen the results of this, and it's amazing. So one day a week, every single week, since the beginning, we believe, they work towards charity.
And what sort of work do they live off? I mean, how do they sustain themselves?
That's a really good question, because they've had their fair share of problems in the past, because what they were trying to do was so seen as so revolutionary that they were chased out of their village by their neighbours, the government changed around that time. So when they eventually returned from exile, they came back to the village to find that their land had been given away by the new government, so which meant that they had very little land to live on and they couldn't grow enough food to sustain themselves. So they learned how to weave. So they're now a weaving community that make beautiful textiles That's their main business
source of income.
They sell the products in the village and also in some nearby markets. And apart from that, they've also been quite entrepreneurial in the sense that they cater for neighboring communities. They have a mill where people come to mill grain. They have a little supermarket now. They have a restaurant.
And they have a small hotel, really. Well,
a little guest house.
A guest house for visitors, because they get an awful lot of tourism now, from Ethiopia, from hundreds of miles away in Ethiopia, just to come and take notes and adopt some of our Rambas' philosophies in their own villages. But they also get quite a lot of international tourists nowadays.
And just wanted to add to that a lot of their income is invested in social welfare, which is something quite unusual
all over the world.
All over the world. But they have a school. They have actually two schools in the village, and one of them they built with their own money and resources, and they have a home for the elderly where people who are old and sick can be cared for 24 hours a day.
They built a high school, which we know costs $50,000, which is an incredible amount of money for our Ramba. And it took them a number of years, and they were promised funding, but the funders pulled out, and they went along and did it anyway. They built a high school which caters for about 650 high school students, and only 20 of those are from our Ramba. Ironically, the remainder are from neighbouring villages, a number of whom used to be our Ramba's enemies. So they've actually done a massively good gesture for their neighbours who used to dislike them.
Now, all this started with the vision of the man who founded the village over 40 years ago, Zumra Nuru. Can you please describe him? What sort of man is he?
For me, Zumra is a genius trapped in the body of a person who couldn't go to school. He had to start work at the age of 4, and he's been working ever since then. But he's also clearly quite eccentric, and I guess he always has been, because we've seen, even the oldest pictures we have of him, he's always been wearing that really wacky green hat.
He's someone who has really gone through a lot of difficulties in the past. He's someone who doesn't give up. He's someone who's persevered through a lot of problems in his life because he has a dream that he really believes in. But he might come across as someone who's quite hard on the surface, but he's really quite soft and gentle underneath. And he's extremely funny. Zumra really has a good sense of humour and makes people laugh when he talks. I would say now, he's the founder and he's in a way the leader of the community, but more and more he's stepping back to allow for the young people to take charge. So he's someone who's very humble and modest for a person who's achieved such big change.
Filmmaker couple Sardar Ferit and Paulina Tervo talking to me from Helsinki there. And if you'd like to find out more about this unique village, just visit the website aramba.com or check them out on Facebook and Twitter. You can also actively support the Aramba experience by contributing to the documentary's crowdfunding campaign. Just click on the banner at the top of their website to make it happen.
And what better way to end the show than with a vision of how great life can be when people all pull together. And on that note, the people pulling together on this week's WorldLink program were Gerd Georgi, Nancy Isenson, Samantha Early and Neil King. And as always, if you'd like to hear any of the items featured on today's program again, just go to dw.de/WorldLink or look us up on iTunes. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.